What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and I hope you enjoyed the last episode with guest host Sebastian Strangio. It was unusual, but I was out on a holiday. For those following on Twitter, you saw the pictures. While I was on holiday, I did this event with the Australian Institute for International Affairs about AUKUS, the unfortunately named Australia-US-UK defense technology agreement, which also involves the transfer of various kinds of cruise missiles and, of course, nuclear-powered submarine technology to Australia. It's touted as the biggest thing going in Asia right now. I think that's a bit overblown, but it's not trivial either. So I was with some really great folks in Australia walking through how to think about AUKUS, how to think of its implications. My angle was, of course, the strategy perspective. What else would it be? And it was a good event, and I've got the audio here. And it's pretty good audio. This was actually a really good event. So it's me, Maria Roast Rubley, nuclear extraordinaire expert, Nick Beasley, and Ben Zala, and Bryce Wakefield, who is the executive director for AIIA. Listen in. I think you'll love it. You're going to learn a lot about AUKUS. You're going to learn that, like, a lot of people are not in love with this thing, despite a lot of the propaganda that's out there. And there are reasons for that, which we go into. So have a listen. Catch you next time. Peace.
All right, Yoma, my name is Bryce Wakefield, and I'm the National Executive Director of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. And I'm coming to you from Canberra, which is the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people. Well, it's been an interesting 2 weeks in Australian foreign affairs, and it's somewhat hard to believe that it's only 2 weeks today that Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom announced a new partnership aimed at fostering deeper integration of security and defense-related science, technology, industrial bases, and supply chains. Since then, we've also seen meetings between the relevant national leaders, as well as those in the Quad and others in Washington. While many of the details of the new partnership are unclear and indeed undecided, the anchor for this new trilateral technology cooperation is, of course, the sale to Australia of nuclear-propelled submarines. This raises a whole load of questions around strategy, around great power relations between the United States and China, issues surrounding proliferation, and questions about Australia's place and relationships within its region. We could probably have separate sessions examining each of these aspects of the AUKUS partnership, and because the Australian Institute of International Affairs runs more events than any other institute of its kind in Australia, we probably will. But for now, we're going to be ambitious and examine the various implications for Australia of this agreement. And I'm very pleased to be joined at this event by our experts, whose bios you can read in the event description. First up, we'll have Van Jackson, who is a senior lecturer in international relations at the Victoria University of Wellington. But today he's coming to us from beautiful Taupo in the heart of New Zealand's North Island. He's got numerous think tank affiliations, and he's also been a practitioner working in the office of the US Secretary of Defense and as an unpaid foreign policy advisor to several US presidential campaigns. Welcome, Van.
Hey, sorry about that. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Nice to see you here. Yes, okay, next up we'll have Benjamin Zala, who is a research fellow in the Department of International Relations at the Australian National University. He's also worked in the United Kingdom at the University of Leicester, the Oxford Research Group, and Chatham House. Hi, Ben.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hi, Bryce.
And after that, we'll have Maria Ross Rubley, who is Associate Professor of International Relations at Monash University. She's worked across several areas of international security, and her work has been supported by the Australian Department of Defense, Canadian Department of National Defense, the US Institute of Peace, and several other organizations. She is past chair of the International Security Studies section of the ISA, an editorial board member of International Affairs, Contemporary Security Policy, and the Non-Proliferation Review. And she's a former editor of International Studies Perspectives. Hi, Maria.
Hello. Thanks, Bryce. Thanks, everyone.
And finally, we'll have Nick Bisley, who is the Dean and Head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences and Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University. He's been a senior research associate of the International Institute of Strategic Studies and a visiting fellow of the East-West Center in Washington, D.C. He's also served as the editor-in-chief of the Australian Journal of International Affairs, and he held that position between 2013 and 2018. And of course, the AJIA is the country's oldest scholarly journal in the field of international relations, and it's also the best. And I don't just say that because we run it. Nick is a fellow of the Australian Institute of International Affairs and a valued member of the AIIA family. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Bryce. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And tick on the product placement. Well done.
Oh, there's more. Before I pass things to our speakers, I want to thank you for joining us. Do remember that we run several events per week on international affairs online and around the country. We're also a membership organization, so you can join up at our local branch, or if you live overseas, you can pick your favorite state and territory in Australia and join up at the branch there. Go to internationalaffairs.org.au, internationalaffairs.org.au, and on the left-hand side, you'll see respectively membership and events. Also, remember to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, AIIA Vision, for delayed video of events, including this one. Now, we'll be taking questions or comments during this session through the Q&A function. And if I choose to ask your question, I will read your name. And if you want me to read out any affiliation, please include it at the end of your question. For now, at least, the upvote function on the questions will be enabled. So if you see a question you like, you can click on it and popular questions will float to the top, where I may choose to read them out or not. So with the housekeeping out of the way, I'll now turn things over to Van to get things started. Van, take it away, please.
Thanks, Bryce, and thanks for letting me phone in from vacation. So I want to talk about this from the Indo-Pacific strategy perspective, but to do that, I kind of have to walk through a series of questions. One, because this arrangement has been justified conceptually in relation to the balance of power, AUKUS, that is, we have to ask, does this shift the correlation of forces? Two, is AUKUS a costly or credible signal of intent? Three, how well coordinated is it with other priorities? Four, does it respond to a realistic diagnosis of the problem facing the Indo-Pacific and facing Australia and the US in particular? And there's a little bit of room for debate in how we answer these questions, but not a lot, right? No matter how reflexively like sanguine or critical you are of AUKUS, the answers to these four specific questions is going to be a mixed bag. So for the first question, I'm gonna try to go through this quickly. Does this shift the balance of power? The answer is pretty clearly no, or at least not foreseeably, right? Because there's so much that's to be determined. And I should say, like, all weapons can be understood as shaping the balance of power, depending on what you mean, or like they technically factor into the balance sheet of forces. But we don't care about making improvements on the margins. We care about decisive shifts. And by that, I mean being able to secure a military objective that we would not otherwise be able to secure, right? Or short of that, we care about introducing asymmetries that give us some kind of operational advantage relative to the other guy, right? And AUKUS, right, and the submarines and the promise of cruise missiles, They don't do that, right? Because the weapon systems on offer, there's nothing asymmetric about them, right? It's all very conventional weapons. What we would describe in the Pentagon as like legacy systems. They're being introduced without an underlying concept that would suggest we're using them differently than we normally would. And therefore, it all plays into the current trajectory of the balance of power, which sort of tilts toward China, right? So given all that, this is what I described in a piece a couple of weeks ago as a vulgar balancing, because you're making military moves, you're justifying these military moves using the rhetoric of the balance of power. But then what you're actually doing is not tipping the scales of the balance of power, right? And there's a question about how you should actually read the balance of power in Asia. There's more than one school of thought about this. We can discuss that if there's time, but for the sake of time, I'm gonna move on quickly to the next question, which is, you know, is AUKUS a credible signal of intent? If we put it differently, is it a costly signal or is it cheap talk, right? And the answer is demonstrably that it's a costly signal in multiple ways. So if you're gonna measure what is considered costly in terms of the balance of power, I think it's feckless. I've made that clear. But that's not the standard for judging a costly signal. It's about sunk costs and tied hands. So the announcement of AUKUS itself, maybe you could argue that that's cheap talk or hollow, right? Not serious. I'm not arguing that. I don't know that anybody's arguing that. But it's costly in the sense that the submarines are themselves a very costly decision against the relationship with France, against the nuclear non-proliferation regime as a risk, right? And a risk accepted. And in terms of Australia making a long-term commitment to the US. So AUKUS credibly signals that this is a cohesive alliance, right? It creates a legal mechanism once there's a contract in place that would tie the US and Australia closer together in a very practical or bureaucratic sense, even though we already are. And it's willing to take on the expense and risk of trying to defend a particular understanding of the status quo in the region, right? So costly signal, credible signal, yes. Third question, how well coordinated is AUKUS with other priorities? Again, there's an element of, you know, TBD in this, but so far it's not very well coordinated at all, right? I think by now everybody understands the rollout was botched. There was no reason to keep this a secret. It had been in the works for over a year. The rollout made the left globally an enemy to this. And I honestly don't think that was inevitable. It's from combining these arms sales decisions with this symbolic P.T. Barnum-like celebration. Solidarity with democracies is a core value of progressives everywhere. For, you know, Australia's, you know, numerous flaws, no U.S. ally is more democratic than Australia. So if you could have separated the submarine announcement from this principle of democratic solidarity, you might have either minimized or scoped some of the politicized backlash to this. And now I feel like it's kind of too late. And that's on top of the row it created with France, the lack of prior coordination with the Quad. And then the final question, does AUKUS respond to a realistic diagnosis of the problem? The answer is kind of yes and no, it depends. To the extent that the balance of military power is an issue, is the problem, AUKUS clearly responds to it, just not well, right? Or not efficiently. But based on US policies the past 4 years, right? Based on how China has been portrayed as a threat in congressional testimonies, in strategy documents, military competition is in the picture, but it's by far not the main issue, right? It's about an illiberal sphere of influence. It's about foreign interference, human rights abuses at scale, economic coercion, obviously now, and technology espionage. And AUKUS is askew of all of that, right? It does not help remedy those problems. And those are the front burner problems, right? And so I've even seen a friend of mine wrote an op-ed saying that we're doing AUKUS as retaliation for Chinese economic coercion of Australia. And I haven't heard any officials say that, and that's a good thing, because that's really stupid, okay? If that's true, if AUKUS is supposed to be our like asymmetric response, it's asymmetric in an asinine way, right? It's a total problem solution mismatch. Militarism is not a response to economic coercion that doesn't resolve anything, right? So having said all that, the most realistic aspect of AUKUS that nobody really talks about, at least in the US, but that's important, is that it does build up an Australian independent blue water capability eventually, or that's the promise. It's up to Australia to decide if they need that. That's a separate debate. But I do think what they need in general is independence from the US military in terms of capability. That's going to be important if America implodes or if America becomes fascist. And these are real risks, right? So in the meantime, we, the US, want to show solidarity to democratic allies at a time when the rules-based order is under strain. And so in those respects, AUKUS does reflect a realistic understanding of the US and the Australian situation in Asia, a realistic need of the alliance to be cohesive, but it's not such a realistic understanding of the situation with China. So those are the four questions, and that's how I sort of read this from a strategy perspective, very much a mixed bag. I think 5-10 years from now, unless AUKUS becomes the catalyst for nuclear proliferation, which is a big caveat, we're going to look back and realize that this was not any kind of game changer for better or worse. And having said all of that, basically everything's TBD, right? This is, we're in the space of like pronouncements. So I'll leave it at that because I know we got a lot to get to.
Okay, great. Thanks, Van. And let's turn things over to Ben.
Okay, thanks, Bryce. So I think a lot of my comments will, some of them will overlap and much of it will pick up from on what Van was just discussing. So I was asked to talk about the great power politics elements of this, what this means for great power politics. And I want to also think a little bit about how the current state of great power politics feeds into this and how this is perhaps a product of thinking about the great power politics, particularly of the region, in one particular way. So what I want to talk a little bit about is the background to the announcement, then talk about the announcement itself, what it means in great power political terms. And if I get time, I'll say a few words about where I think this goes from here, what this means for the future of all of this stuff. So in terms of backdrop or background, I think it's fair to say that this comes, and I think it's important to remind ourselves actually, that this comes at a time in which the evolution, the elevation of great power politics, making great power politics central to the foreign policies of both the US and China has been going on for a number of years. It's what's often referred to in the media and elsewhere as the return of great power politics. And actually, I think there's something to this idea of the return. Yeah, it's the trendy position is to say, well, great power politics, of course, never went away. It can't return if it was never gone. But actually, I think one of the big impacts of the end of the Cold War was that the relations between major powers took a backseat to other concerns and took a more level seating to other concerns. And now that is shifting again. I think from the Obama administration onwards, I don't think you can date it from before then, but I think from the Obama administration, particularly the second term of Obama's administration onwards, we see this in US foreign policy. And then officially under the Trump administration, if you look at the Trump administration's national security policy, it puts great power competition front and center. And this has been continued under Biden. And I think, as I said, we've seen this in Chinese foreign policy over roughly the same period, and particularly once Xi Jinping comes to power as well. And of course, not only is it the elevation of great power politics, but it's the hardening of both sides to view great power politics through one particular lens. And that's the lens of direct competition, or what's often referred to in Washington as strategic competition. This is the kind of buzzword of the moment. And what's happened is that this has become the single lens for looking at these issues. There is no other way to think about them. So every announcement you make, every policy decision you make is somehow relating to thinking of great power politics in terms of direct, strategic, if you like, zero-sum competition. That's not inevitable. That's not natural. It doesn't have to happen that way, but that is what's happened as a background to this announcement. In terms of the announcement itself, what does this mean for the three players, part of the awkwardly named AUKUS arrangement? What does it mean? Well, for the US, I think it's fairly obvious. The timing of this was important. Vance spoke a little bit about the way that the announcement was handled. I think for the US, it's no coincidence that this was delayed to come out directly after the withdrawal from Afghanistan. This was a highly visible projection of the idea that the US sees itself in direct competition with China in Asia, and that this is now the number one priority. No more distractions in the Middle East and Central Asia, no more domestic turmoil distracting from foreign policy goals. We're back, and we are back to do one thing, which is to challenge China's rising power and status. So the announcement from the US point of view allows it to do that. And it's a nice, highly visible, kind of headline grabbing way of doing so. For the UK, it's an interesting one. I think this is ultimately an attempt to project relevance and status outside of Europe. This is a post-Brexit thing. This is a way of projecting to the world that the global Britain idea is more than just rhetoric. So this is the idea that the UK will matter to the world's most economically dynamic and strategically important region, this part of the world. Of course, there's the added bonus of the nature of the announcement with the submarine deal, meaning that it made the French look less relevant and less important in the politics of the Asia Pacific, which of course is a good news day in London, but that's a bonus. And I think that was central to what played out. For Australia, what does this mean? Well, as Van said, there is a lot of more of the same, right? For all the breathless stuff in the media, saying this is the greatest change in Australian defence policy in decades and all the rest. I mean, the day that Australia announcing that it's going to cooperate more with the United States and the United Kingdom signals the greatest change in Australian defence policy in decades. Well, that tells us a lot about stasis and continuity in Australian defence policy, right? But it's a further extension of what I think of as a politically settled position that enjoys bipartisan support. It's now a very well-established sort of conventional wisdom across the foreign policy establishment, from journalists to pundits to analysts, think tankers and the rest, which is a full acceptance of the American view of how power and order should be organized in Asia. Of course, given the nature of the deal that it's part of, this is about defense procurement, it also allows Australia to allay some of those fears of what people like Alan Gingell and others refer to as Australia's perennial fear of abandonment of its great power sponsors. So the perception of the Morrison government is that not only will the Australian Defence Force gain access to high-end defence technology that it wouldn't otherwise have access to, but more importantly, this deal will include things like building new submarines that, due to the nature of how they're powered, they're nuclear-powered, are very likely to require a higher level of ongoing American involvement in the running and servicing of these things for reasons of nuclear safeguards, but even the other things, the upgrading of ports and facilities, collaborating in other defence areas and so forth. This will, in a practical sense, mitigate the chances of a serious US withdrawal from Asia. It'll make it much harder for the US to withdraw, even if domestic forces within the US push in that direction in the years to come. So it's a hedge against that happening. Thinking about what this means more broadly about the future of great power relations in Asia, I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that it's going to be very difficult to avoid the further spiraling of US-China relations into a Cold War setting. Now, there's lots of silly things written about how this isn't a new Cold War, which always falls into the same trap of assuming that a Cold War, lowercase c, lowercase w, has to be identical in all forms to the Cold War, capital C, capital W, or what we might think of as the US-Soviet confrontation in the post-war period. Of course, a Cold War is a way of relating to each other. There could be all sorts of examples of Cold Wars from history. I think we are in the early stages of a new Cold War. And of course, there'll be things that'll be similar to the last, things that will be different. Nor do I think it's inevitable that great power relations go down that path. But I think it's difficult to escape the conclusion that this is the mindset, both in Beijing and Washington and across US allies. So for the US and its allies, including Australia, the way this is thought of is that the baseline for China's rise is effectively ignored. It's no longer treated as a rising power coming from behind in the context of being the number two power in its own region. It's now treated as a risen power and an inherently aggressive one. Any increase in Chinese power, any increase in how China uses its power, any increase in Chinese assertiveness is seen as being inherently, by definition, destabilizing. And then the corollary of this is also held to be true, that any increase in US power, including helping to grow the capabilities of its allies, is inherently stabilizing. And any state that is seen to not agree with this view of how power and order should be organized in Asia is sort of written off as being in China's thrall. It must be under China's thumb for some reason. Germany is your classic example of this, right? The Germans are often criticized by the US and US allies as being a bit dovish on China. And the argument is always, well, look at all the trade they're doing with China. It's just, it's economics. They're being sort of cutthroat about things. And it's true that China is now Germany's biggest trading partner in terms of two-way trade. But actually, despite the fact that Chinese exports to German exports to China have grown and they've become the second largest export market, Germany's largest export market is still the United States. And you know who else has China as its major trading partner in terms of two-way trade? Australia. So the idea that having a major trading relationship with China must put you in thrall to China is obviously patently ridiculous. But this is the mindset in which we take it, that anybody who has a different view of how great power relations might play out, and that assuming that arms racing and spiraling is not a good idea, falling into a Cold War mentality is not the smartest way of handling great power relations today. They must be thinking that way for some other nefarious reason. They couldn't possibly just have a different view of how great power politics plays out. So that hardening of positions is likely to continue. And I think this deal certainly puts Australia very firmly on one side of that. I think the final thing just to raise is to flag the interesting question, which I think for me at this stage is an open question, although I think there's hints in this direction, as to whether the other two partners in the AUKUS agreement, the UK and Australia, will join the Biden administration's particular slant on great power competition at the moment, which is a little different from the previous two administrations, which is to give it a specifically ideological character. This is this idea that Van mentioned of sort of grouping democracies together specifically. Biden's very keen on this idea of the language changes, sometimes it's an alliance of democracies, sometimes it's a grouping of democracies and so forth, of putting regime type, the fact that we're a democracy and not an autocracy or theocracy or something else, at the heart of this. And I think from the Morrison government, we're seeing early signs in that direction, talking about a balance of power that favours freedom, this sort of thing. But whether the UK and Australia might be less enthusiastic about this or more enthusiastic about it, I think is an open question. And it'll be interesting to see whether AUKUS is used for these purposes or not. So I'll leave my remarks there, I think. Thanks, Bryce.
Great, thank you so much, Ben. And we'll now go to Maria for her take.
Wonderful, thanks, Bryce. And thanks to all the participants and of course my fellow panelists. So, my background is in nuclear politics. I've worked for the US intelligence agency doing nuclear related work. And but before I talk about the nuclear dimension to this, to the AUKUS arrangement, I wanna just raise a couple of bigger questions. I mean, no doubt here within Australia, I think a lot of people feel like this announcement makes us feel like we're part of this inner circle. You know, the US trusted partner in the Indo-Pacific to have access to this very secretive technology that the US has only shared with the UK. I would say that we have to get past that warm glow and ask a lot of questions, many of which are being asked right here at this panel. What makes the most sense for Australian defense? Because the proposal raises many more questions than it answers. What do 8 nuclear submarines actually get us? If ASPE estimates you need at least 24 submarines for sea denial, let alone sea control, what do 8 give us? What's the cost? The estimate I saw this morning was at least 50% more than the $90 billion we were spending for French submarines to get us 8 submarines that don't get us anywhere near what we need for sea denial. Yeah, I've read over the past couple of weeks, a lot of people praising nuclear submarines, why they're so great for Australia, what they can do in the Pacific. There's no question nuclear submarines have great capacity that would be really useful for Australia. But the question for Australia is not what nuclear submarines can do, we understand that, but does Australia have the national capacity and funds to actually get them? And at what opportunity cost? What will we not be getting if we spend not just money, but our national attention, our national human capital on a nuclear submarine project? And so I'd like to raise a couple of questions specifically on the nuclear dimension that can get us thinking about some of these issues. The first is, and I'm not sure if anyone, I have not seen this clarified in the press, but if it's come out, feel free to let me know. I mean, my biggest concern is nuclear propelled submarines run based on a nuclear reactor, like a mini power plant within nuclear submarines. Who is going to be supplying the fuel for that nuclear reactor? It will require highly enriched uranium because both UK and US subs run on highly enriched uranium. If Australia intends to enrich uranium for its own submarines, that is a major issue. Alarm bells will go off, not just in our region, but around the world. The spread of enrichment technology, although technically allowed under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, it's something that the US and other countries have tried to put dramatic limits on. The US has pressured South Korea, for example, on it. And if Australia says this is something we want and we plan to supply the HEU, then that's a whole nother discussion. I'm hoping that there is a question, if this hasn't been clarified yet, why is that? The government would, I think, assuage a lot of concerns if they would just come out and say, we intend to, like the UK, use HEU supplied by the US. And so the fact that that hasn't been a broad announcement, at least not one that I've seen yet, raises some concerns because that's something we really do need. To hear that we're not going to be enriching uranium here in Australia. That's a huge proliferation concern. But even if the HEU is supplied by the US, we still have the question about our national capacity. You see, if we're going to have nuclear submarines, we need a nuclear industry, even if we're not supplying the enriched uranium. Now, I want to be upfront. We have world-class nuclear scientists and facilities at ANSTO, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of those researchers and scientists. But they work on medical and research issues, not military. It's quite different. And if you just think about the types of things that we would need our nuclear industry oriented, the submarines won't have to be refueled during their lifetime because of the way that the US and UK submarines are designed, but we're still going to have to operate, maintain, and repair them. And that's what requires the nuclear industry. So we need maintenance, not just to the reactor, but to all the affiliated components. We need to be able to repair nuclear submarines, including not just in dry dock, but what if you're in operation deep in the Pacific and you have a problem with your reactor? We've got to have the national capacity, which means we need the training, which means we need the educational programs to be able to produce submariners and maintenance technicians who can handle these types of issues. In addition, we need from the ground up a safety and quality control framework to be established for operating, maintaining military nuclear reactors. So we need people trained, submariners, maintenance personnel. We need these safety and quality control frameworks established. We also need regulatory and legal frameworks because the ones we have now are very tightly constrained that only allow a medical and research capability to our nuclear work within Australia. And so my guess is that these are going to have to be adjusted as well. So what's our national capacity? Well, today we have one nuclear engineering program in Australia at University of New South Wales. It's very small, only a couple of lectures. And in fact, at UQ, there's a scholarship in nuclear energy, and it's to allow students who are interested in nuclear energy to study overseas at an institution that actually offers nuclear engineering. So it's no wonder that we heard, for example, when Tony Abbott criticized the Turnbull government for going with the French submarines, sort of the French nuclear submarines redesigned so that, you know, they'd be conventional submarines. Tony Abbott, you know, criticized that, and Maurice Payne came out and said, let's be honest, that would require a nuclear industry for us to have nuclear submarines, and it would take longer to develop the nuclear industry than it would to actually build the nuclear submarines. And that is certainly the case. Christopher Pine just argued a few months ago, there's more chance of me winning the 100 meter sprint at the Tokyo Olympics than Australia developing a nuclear industry to support such a fleet. So I have a lot of concerns that there's all this excitement about, you know, these glossy, amazing toys that will get us closer to the Americans, but we don't have the capacity and we don't have the money for it. I want to raise a couple of questions that I'm happy to talk about in comments, because I've seen comments in the chat and that have also been raised by some of our regional allies, et cetera, some of our regional neighbors. Will nuclear submarines based in Australia carry nuclear weapons? And I would say there's two ways to think about that question. One is, you know, we will have a nuclear submarine base if this goes ahead, they're saying off the west coast of Australia, and it's going to serve as a base for US and UK nuclear submarines. And they certainly will carry nuclear weapons. That does not mean Australia will. And I think that Australia is, you know, a member of the NPT, is not permitted, you know, has forsworn, you know, the ability to create its own nuclear weapons. And I don't think there's any immediate, you know, desire to, you know, move away from that. But there's no question that we will have US and UK nuclear submarines, you know, based off our West Coast, and they'll have nuclear weapons in it. I want to raise just one final point just to get you thinking. If the UK only has one nuclear submarine base, and if they lose that, they have to disarm because they have no other place to dock their nuclear submarines. If they lose their only only nuclear submarine base, which they will if Scottish independence goes ahead, will they want to use Australia as a permanent base until they're able to build one somewhere on the English coastline? And is that something that, you know, I think Australians as a democratic society should think about? This isn't just about having nuclear submarines, but it's also about having nuclear weapons based off of the Australian coast. Thanks.
All right, very good. Thanks very much. Lots of food for thought there. Let's go to Nick.
Thanks, Bryce. And I've been asked to focus a bit on the sort of broader regional consequences of this announcement. And I think it is important, as all of my fellow panelists have pointed out, is that where we are at with AUKUS is an announcement. We've got a press release and a promise to talk about submarines for 18 months and nothing else. So let's be really clear that what we're talking about here is an announcement. And with the Morrison government's track record on announcements and follow through, you know, you wouldn't want to overread this. But announcements matter, signals matter. As Van said, you know, signaling in international relations is a big deal in and of itself. And in that sense, the regional consequences of these signals, I think, are important to look at and to think through. And to sort of, interestingly, gauging the way in which it's been responded, that the announcement the reactions to the announcement across the region have played out. You know, of course, you've seen some countries be quite sanguine about it. Singapore, Tokyo, although even Tokyo's response was fairly, you know, they welcomed it, but, you know, NPT concerns and things like that. So even at a, you know, a card-carrying member of the, you know, We Love America club was not entirely enamored of what this represents. But outside of that, you know, you've seen considerable variation of attitudes. Malaysia, Indonesia, most obviously have expressed publicly some unease about things. You know, it's cautious, it's very ASEAN style. No one's pointing any fingers and making anyone embarrassed. But when you put that kind of context on it to see this sort of public eyebrow raising in Southeast Asia, it's noticeable. And I think the broader sense, and something I want to get back to towards the end of my comments, about how this is just an announcement of three, frankly, you know, pale, male, stale guys talking about a future of which only two of them inhabit and one barely just, it sends some fairly backward-looking signals. And the sort of sense around not bringing other, whether you want to use the term like-minded, similar value system, or just interest-sharing countries in the region together as part of a big strategic initiative, I think itself is telling. And that desire to staple together the arms element and the broader strategic move was itself kind of puzzling. A second point, though, I think is interesting from a regional point of view, is the way in which AUKUS, and not just AUKUS, but also the Quad, has illustrated, I think, some of the very real shortcomings of the existing regional institutions, most obviously ASEAN, but not only. And that's to say, you know, if you had to get a score the regional institutions in the region by their, you know, actions, dynamism, responsiveness to issues, the running that is certainly a lot of the energy and initiative is being played by non-ASEAN institutions. And of course, ASEAN has always styled itself as the premier regional entity in the quote unquote the driver's seat of regionalism. And yet it's the extra ASEAN institutions that have a lot of initiative. And that's not to say that what they're doing is right or to endorse it. When you put that alongside the fact that ASEAN itself is clearly, the membership is not entirely aligned, what you see in AUKUS is an illustration of the very real shortcomings of ASEAN. Now, what that will do over time will be interesting to watch. Certainly, you know, as one of the sad members of the International Relations Club who spends a lot of time watching ASEAN, one thing we know is that organization works best when it feels threatened by its, if that's position of preeminence and regional institutions feel threatened. So we'll see what the reaction might be. But one of the most striking facets of AUKUS is the truly astonishingly bad diplomacy that led up to it. I mean, the idea that you would do something like this, which is a big deal, without any diplomatic spadework to soften the ground, whether it's with the French, a genuine Indo-Pacific power, probably the only actual Indo-Pacific power going at the moment, without bringing your closest neighbor in Indonesia, ostensibly your special strategic partners in places like Tokyo and Singapore and others, to develop things is really astonishing. It's as if the government either doesn't care or doesn't understand the idea of side costs with this kind of thing. It's really quite remarkable. And I think that alongside the indirect signaling of a kind of love of the Anglosphere or a backward-looking sense of where the region's future is, sends, I think, entirely the wrong signals. And, you know, we do well to remind ourselves that all three of these countries have a long colonial past that is not particularly well regarded in the region, that the memories of the White Australia policy in the region are pretty fresh. And when you combine these together to say, hey, it's the white guys coming to save the region, I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious on that, but there is a sense of, you know, a pretty ill thought through set of diplomatic signaling, which we're going to pay some price. Not catastrophic, not the end of the world, but I think it's there. And when you're working out what strategic initiatives you're going to be implementing, the sort of things Van was mentioning about the kind of costs and signaling and the benefits of these things, I think that has to be part of the consideration, particularly given what it is now, which is simply a signaling exercise. So what can be done around all of this? I mean, I think, again, slightly surprised that at the start there wasn't a desire to broaden the base of a strategic initiative to, you know, develop new technology around AI or all of the sort of things separate from the nuclear tech, the nuclear submarine question, that you don't bring in a broader range of countries that share a set of interests to retain, you know, whether it's a centered around a regional order that's positively disposed to freedom, or whether it's more openly described as about corralling Chinese influence in these key pieces of technology infrastructure, But there's lots of countries that share these interests, and yet to do it without any of them, I think, is a mistake. And I think the first step that if we're serious about this and we're serious about the ambitions to ensure the region's future is more liberal than it looks like it's going to be at the moment, then you need to bring a range of countries together. And I think if AUKUS can ditch its awful acronym and move itself out to, I don't like the term Indo-Pacific, but an Indo-Pacific Alliance of Democracies or, something. And even that itself is, the democracy element has challenges because of the regime diversity in the region. The moment you put values at the center of strategy, you've got a challenge in a region like ours in which there's such diverse sets of interests and ideas. And then I guess the final point, it was sort of echoing something that Ben said, and that's one of the things when you look at the regional reactions to AUKUS, you see, and I think it's important for countries like Australia, Japan, the US and the UK to remind themselves, is that not everyone sees the actions of the US and others as an unalloyed good, that everything America does must therefore be a good thing, and that the US and its allies represent a neutral, legalistic, reasonable regional order, and that anyone who seeks to disrupt it is sort of falling short and doesn't see the value of what they're doing. There is a diversity of views out there, and that we need to make the case that if you think this is an important thing to do, we need to make the case to convince people and not see everyone in that kind of binary way, which is if you don't agree that the retention of the existing regional order centered around, American military primacy or however you want to define it, therefore you must be a pandahugger, or therefore you must be some sort of, in the take of, and the problem is, of course, as most of us sit in universities, we're all inherently suspicious because we're clearly in the back pocket of Beijing because of student fees that we get, and that, which, I've had it put to me repeatedly. But I think this is a moment that does remind us of the fact that not everyone sees the presence of American military power, the status quo as it has been for the past few decades, as an unalloyed good, and that we have a job of work in front of us to make that case. And I don't think AUKUS is a particularly good way of doing it.
Okay, very good. Right, now we will go to Q&A soon. I just have a few questions of my own that I want to talk about. I'll go first to Ben and Van. I'll group you together. So Ben, in particular, kind of framed the American response the American motivation of AUKUS as sort of reconfirming America's commitment to the region after what we've seen in Afghanistan. And I think that's been a consistent sort of part of the analysis that I've seen, at least in Australia so far, particularly when we look at the comments of those like Paul Keating or Alan Gingell, who have talked about the arrangements binding us so closely to the United States that we end up with a loss of sovereignty as America sort of plows forth with its strategy in the region. And I'm wondering if there is another interpretation of what the US is up to here, and I'm wondering what you think about it. So Bilahari Kausikan in, I think, the Straits Times talked about this as a sort of complement to a US offshore balancing policy, where actually the US is it senses its weakness, which is a discussion that is also ongoing among people like Hugh White, for example, and that the United States is drawing back from the region. I was also at a IISS webinar last night where Raja Mohan was arguing sort of the same thing. What's your take on that perspective? Because it seems to be diametrically opposed to what you're talking about in terms of America's motivations here. As Ben really focused on this, I'll go with him first and then see what Van has to say.
Sure, yeah. I don't buy the argument that this is a stepping stone to US withdrawal from the region, mainly because I don't see any of the other decisions being made by the Biden administration, nor any of the other rhetoric from the administration. None of the thinking in policy terms pointing in that direction. I see it going in the opposite direction. It's now the conventional wisdom in DC is that great power competition is back. Now, there is this, I guess, qualification to this, in which it's normally couched in terms of we are now in an era of great power competition. There's us and China and Russia. It's a three-way competition, right? So a multipolar order. However, generally speaking, it's China that's taking up, you know, sort of 70 to 80% of the oxygen in the room, as it were, at least at the current time. Because the feeling is that the US really dropped the ball in the Asia Pacific, and China is the one with the ability, the material capabilities to really set up a serious challenge. The basic logic of this position isn't necessarily incompatible with what's often referred to as an offshore balancing position. So the offshore balancing position is basically you don't necessarily want to get into Asia and fight China on its doorstep on every issue, whether that's militarily or economically or diplomatically. But what you want to do is ideally have your allies do it for you first, right? But the key aspect, the key goal here is keeping China down from being a regional hegemon. Because if you allow a regional hegemon in any other region of the world to become so comfortable in its region that it doesn't need to worry about internal challenges to it, it'll be free to kind of make problems in your region. That's the basic kind of logic that sits behind it. So I don't see this as a stepping stone to the US getting out of the region. This is part of entrenching its position in the region. I see nothing. And when I say nothing, I can't underline that and asterisk it anymore if I tried. No evidence whatsoever, unfortunately, I think, for serious discussion in DC about whether the US should be in Asia. That's just not even discussed. The whole idea of the US being a Pacific power has been deeply, deeply internalized. The geographic distance of the Pacific Ocean is just imagined not to matter. And the US is an Asian power. Now, anyone who takes the blinkers off knows that's ridiculous. The US chooses to be in Asia. There's nothing natural, there's nothing God-given. The US could leave. It is entirely possible to not have the presence that it does in Asia. It could have a much, much lower presence, but I don't think that's going to happen because there is no discussion about that as an option. It's just, what should our presence be in Asia? So the boundaries of that discussion are narrowed considerably. And so I don't see this as a stepping stone to any serious attempt to get out of Asia. I see it in the opposite direction. Depending on who comes after Biden, that might change, right? But under the Biden administration, I see no thinking that they want to have that this is handing over to the allies to do it for them. This is bolstering the allies to keep the US firmly in Asia.
Right, Van, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm 99% down with that. Like that's 100% right. It's 99% right. Like there's this administration in particular, and I say this lamentably, is explicitly committed to a quote unquote favorable balance of power that ensures them and their allies can't even be threatened, let alone attacked. They literally said that. I know all the people in the administration, everybody who's doing defense policy comes from that unipolar moment mindset. Like they are living in the past. As smart as they are, 90% of them living in the past. So they're not looking to get out or divest or introduce forms of restraint. And the funny thing is that people should know, in Australia especially, the intellectual conversation around foreign policy in Washington outside of the administration, so like in the think tank industry and in academia, it is looking for off-ramps, not to like withdraw from the region, but to right-size its role in the region. Because the idea that America does the balancing on behalf of everyone else in a region where there's a risen hegemon is not realistic. That is unipolar moment stuff, right? So that paradigm is going to change, is not going to change under Biden. There's no evidence of that. Bill Ahari, God bless him, he's wrong. He's super wrong.
Okay, that's pretty definitive. Right, let's... I did have one for Nick, but unfortunately you answered it during your talk, so I'm going to skip you, Nick, sorry. Don't worry, I'll give you some in the Q&A. But to Maria, a lot of your talk focused on, the prospects of proliferation. What would we call it, proliferation? The prospects of a civil nuclear industry in Australia. I've read other stuff that has seemed to suggest that there is a real sort of international proliferation risk here as well, in that supplying nuclear material, particularly highly enriched uranium, to a non-nuclear weapons state like Australia for propulsion gives other powers the opportunity to argue that they should be enriching uranium in their own civil nuclear facilities, and therefore taking it out of the International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards. And that creates perhaps a risk that, you know, they might monkey around with it and develop their own nuclear weapons. Can you address that to some degree? Is that a real fear?
Yes, I mean, there's certainly good reason to worry about that, because the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it permits fissile material to be withdrawn from IAEA safeguards for non-explosive military purposes, such as naval propulsion. Therefore, IAEA safeguards are how we all know that other countries aren't cheating. And HEU is material that could be directly used in a bomb. So we're more concerned about HEU than we are, for example, material in a nuclear power plant, which is going to be low enriched uranium, or MOX fuel, which is a mix of plutonium and low enriched uranium. And so, you know, it is possible that HEU could be removed from IAEA safeguards for use in naval propulsion, and then be refashioned into bomb cores for a breakout scenario. And we wouldn't know, because they've been withdrawn from the nuclear safeguard, the IAEA safeguards. I mean, look, it's very unlikely, you know, I don't have any concern about Australia doing that, but that's not the question. The question is, does this set a precedent? If Australia is, encouraged by the US to have, HEU, fueled nuclear submarines, then that gives other countries around the world the right to say, well, we would like them too. I mean, Brazil has been working on nuclear submarines for quite a long time, and there's been a lot of pressure on them. There's been a lot of, I don't want to say condemnation, but, a lot of people sort of looking at them sideways saying, what are you planning on doing that with that? If this does go ahead, then certainly Brazil, we won't be able to say that to Brazil, and certainly, other countries will say we have the right as well. And this is especially the case if Australia wants to enrich its own uranium. I mean, I can't overemphasize how bad of an idea that would be, because once you have the same material, the same equipment you use to enrich uranium for nuclear power plants or for nuclear reactors in a submarine, it's the very same equipment you use to create fissile material for nuclear weapons. And you can hide these things, we can find them, like we found the ones in Iran, but it's hard to do so. And if, South Korea said, we would like to enrich our uranium, and they have a good reason to do so in terms of, they have a very large, a large proportion of their energy comes from nuclear power, and for energy security, they'd like to be able to do this. And the U.S. put enormous pressure on them, and South Korea resisted it, but in the end, they agreed they wouldn't do it. So if the U.S., okays Australia enriching, its own uranium for these submarines, all bets would be off, and we would see the spread of enrichment technology, all over. It would be very hard to contain, in my opinion. And that just means we're going to see the spread of nuclear weapons, which isn't a good idea from anybody's viewpoint, unless you're one of those few people who hold to that Ken Waltz idea that more nuclear weapons are better. And very few people these days hold to that.
Okay, right, I'd better go to the Q&A and I'll ask the first question to Nick because we've neglected him. There's a couple of questions. I want to group them together. There's one from Yutaka Yazawa, who says very stimulating presentations, but there's been very scarce analysis on what impact AUKUS has on Australia-China relations, which surely must be the number one consideration way ahead, they say, of fancy abstract great power balance analysis. Given that Beijing seems to have started recalling their wolf warrior diplomats, Australia flexing or appearing to be ready to flex its muscle seems to have served its purpose. Do you agree, Nick? Does the panel agree? And I'll go to a different one that's from the same topic from a different perspective. And that was a couple of days ago, China Tonight on SBS played a segment where the Chinese guest said that Australia was now on the path to nuclear retaliation. If memory serves me correctly, that was Victor Gao, the former translator of Deng Xiaoping. He said that it couldn't be taken seriously, that a nuclear-powered submarine would not in any way play host to nuclear weapons, and therefore Australia could be targeted. Do you feel this will be a widespread international view, or is there enough global trust in Australia about this issue? This might be one where I'll get Maria's comments after Nick's. Furthermore, is it enough for China to hold this view to sway Australian policy? And that's from Naomi Panzo, and she's here in Canberra.
So on the first matter of how this is going to affect the bilateral relationship, I mean, if you start with Fan's basic point, with which I agree entirely, which is this going to change the strategic balance in the region? No. So if you're China and you're looking at this and go, does this matter in terms of what China's military strategic ambitions are? Zero, absolutely no effect whatsoever. The bilateral relationship is probably about as bad as it's been since recognition of the PRC in the 1970s. It could get worse. I think if we haven't learned anything from the past 5 years, it's never say never, never say things can't get worse, they always can. Trump's gift to us, as was the pandemics. But I think I think this is just seen as yet more grist in the mill of Australian, hairy-chested diplomacy, often hairy-chested for no obvious strategic reason. You know, we've led with our chin on China for reasons that are not entirely clear. I get what we're trying to achieve in the sense of, you know, trying to see off foreign interference and these sorts of things, but to do it in the way that it has been done has been entirely counterproductive. You know, the fact that Australia has essentially a non-functioning relationship with the region's most important economy and the world's second most important power seems to me diplomatically not a smart play. But I think from a just in purely in terms of the bilateral relationship, it's just another sort of on the ledger of things over which the countries are having a bad time and isn't going to be turned around. I mean, I think the one glimmer of hope possibly is the fact that it does seem that Xi Jinping's China has realized that the audience outside of Zhongnanhai for Chinese foreign policy and diplomatic noises matters, and that kind of wolf warrior stuff doesn't go down particularly well, and that they seem as if they're going to try to chart a slightly different course. But I think that's separate from this particular set of announcements. So my sense, I think, as I said in my comments, was that the side costs or the consequences, the negative consequences, as such as they may be, from the announcement, is less to do with Beijing and more to do with other parts of the region and poor diplomacy and poor signaling in that regard. On the, does this put a target on Australia's back? Van and in fact all the panelists know more about this than me, so I'd sort of defer to their judgment. But my sense, I think, is no. You know, I think it's If you buy the kind of targeting stuff, yes, we have been and will always be, as long as we've got the various installations in Pine Gap and the north. If you take that sort of Cold War perspective, that's still there. China would always, you imagine if you play it forward that target is there. Are these submarines any more targeted? I doubt it. Even if they're nuclear, um, if even if in a very unlikely scenario, the nuclear armed, only because there's so few of them. You know, there's going to be 8 of them, maybe 10, you know, oof, watch out. Well, they will get a special Australian target to get them, as opposed to all of the American ones and all of the other ones. So I think it's a sort of predictable response, but I don't think it's a meaningful one. But as I said, my fellow panelists all know more about this than I do, so.
Okay, fellow panelists. Maria, do you want to take a stab?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if there is a nuclear submarine base on the, you know, off the west coast of Australia, yes, that will be a target, but it's not as though Australia is not already doesn't have targets such as Pine Gap. So, I mean, I don't, that's a small issue. I mean, it's a big issue for people, you know, but in terms of like the big issues that Australia is asking about this, that this is a relatively smaller one. So I'd agree with Nick on that, that it's not going to suddenly, you know, race Australia up the list of China's nuclear target.
Great. Van, did you have anything to add? I see you thumbs up.
I just gave a thumbs up. I didn't know if you could see it, but yeah, I agree. That's that. Australia was already a target, right? But this doesn't like dramatically increase the likelihood of anything. And the, you know, nobody's saying this, but like US naval intelligence estimated before this whole AUKUS thing that by 2030, China would have 6 more nuclear powered submarines. And that was steady state before they knew Australia was going to try to get into a race or whatever with a guy who's 20 times faster than you. So like this is all such a joke. This is it. There's so much jingoism going on. This military, like, this, I'm sorry, I'll stop. Well, let's do Q&A.
No, yeah, well, all good. Okay, well, we've got a couple of questions here about the Pacific and New Zealand. It might be a good idea to kind of answer those separately, because we've actually got quite a good panel here for New Zealand. I know, Maria, you used to live there, and Van, of course, you're sitting in paradise right now. And I'm as Australian as Pavlova, of course. We'll first go to Tess Newton-Cain, who is the project lead at the Pacific Hub at Griffith University. The announcements associated with AUKUS have raised concerns as expressed by Pacific Island leaders. What can we expect to see from the AUKUS partners to address those issues and reassure Pacific partners that they are not being caught up in a geostrategic competition not of their making? And the other question is from Kiara Mitchell, it's the most popular question at the moment. And she is, of course, from the Diplomatic Podcast, which is a little outfit that Van Jackson runs. Beware if you listen to it, it's full of F-bombs. What is the implication of AUKUS for New Zealand, the Pacific region, and their relationships with Australia, the UK, and the US? I think, Nick, can we go back to you for the Pacific?
Yeah, look, I'll just be really quick on this. I think what you'll get from AUKUS, not what we ought to get, but what we will get, will be platitudes. We'll get the same sort of things that they said. We, as they issued in the AUSMIN, we respect ASEAN centrality, we respect ASEAN-centered institutions, and we value the ASEAN process, and the, all of which is plainly bunker. And I think that's likely what you're going to get to say from AUKUS in relation to this, to the Pacific Island nations, to say, what we see is, what we present is a vision of the future in which we're seeking to ensure a free and open resilient Indo-Pacific order, and that AUKUS will provide a resilient and inclusive approach to all of this. And we have, and the subtext is, we have no intention of listening to you in any way seriously or to take your interests particularly seriously. And I don't want to sound too cynical, but I think at the moment, if you look at the way in which certainly the Australian government looks at and operates its Pacific policy, it's viewed purely, you know, the importance of the Pacific at the moment for the government is purely through the lens of how does this fit in with our broader strategic relationship, and our interest in the Pacific has once again been prompted by, frankly, you know, I think overblown concerns about Chinese influence. It's then wrapped up in a language of neo-paternalist development aid and the like, but the substance of what's really there is, you know, and everyone in the Pacific knows it, is that it's entirely disingenuous. AUKUS is entirely out of that playbook. So I wouldn't hold your breath that at some points quite divergent interests of the Pacific Island nations and those of the AUKUS 3 will be brought to any kind of alignment anytime soon. But maybe I'm being a bit too pessimistic.
Okay, great. Van, Maria, Ben, do you have anything to add to that? If not, can we talk specifically about New Zealand maybe?
Well, I'd just like to jump in on the Pacific. If you all recall, there is this new treaty called the Treaty for the TPNW, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, and which basically bans countries from having nuclear weapons. And of course, the nuclear weapon states don't support this. But it's now entered into force because enough states have ratified it. And over a third of the states that have signed and ratified it are in the Pacific. And that's because a lot of these Pacific countries have experienced the horrors of nuclear testing and environmental and human health catastrophes from nuclear testing. And both Malaysia has ratified the TPNW and Indonesia has signed it. And so these countries are saying, Australia, you snubbed your nose at the TPNW. You wouldn't even enter discussions in about it. You're certainly not going to sign it. And now you're doing this nuclear agreement with the US and the UK. And I think this is a real issue for Pacific countries. It doesn't mean that I don't think Australia is going to respond to that or even really hear that, because for them, the overwhelming sort of, drumbeat is, what do we do to counter China? And, we got to stick close to the US. I mean, I think that's problematic, but I think that's the way it is. And so they're not going to hear that, but it is going to result in further erosion to trust in Australia's, credibility and interest in Pacific Islands and in Southeast Asia.
Can I just add a vote of confidence for Nick's pessimism, lest he feels too out on his own in that, in the sense that actually I think you can say this for the Pacific, but you can actually go for any of the regional responses that are in any way concerned, right? If the concern is that right at the moment, the so-called Asian century, when great power politics seems to be returning and things are getting tense and so forth, and there are all these concerns about an increasing militarism in the region and genuine concerns about arms racing, if the concern is that Australia's response to this trend is, well, we're going to announce a doubling down with allies from outside the region who happen to be both former colonial powers, Anglo-colonial powers from the region. So it's not to find some new way or propose some new way of dealing with conflicts or anything like that. It's, we're going to double down with the US and we're going to bring the Brits back in. So if that's on the one hand, and then what are you going to do with those two? Oh, we're going to sign arms deals. We're going to get more submarines out into these waters at the outset of an arms race. So if the concern is, oh, that doesn't feel great for us, Nick's exactly right. There is nothing that Australia can do other than give platitudes, because that's all this announcement is. It's palling up with former Anglo-imperial powers and signing arms deals. You can't, address those concerns with anything else, because that's precise. Their concern relates directly to what we've just announced.
Yeah, I agree with everything everybody said, and I would only add that the way this was rolled out was not just a tactical error. It was the biggest, loudest communication possible that the AUKUS countries don't give two flips about what everyone else thinks. They don't. And otherwise they would have consulted beforehand. The US government knows how to do pre-socialization rollouts, and they didn't do it, right? New Zealand, to get to the question, found out 12 hours before it was announced on the news, New Zealand's part of Five Eyes, and you find out at the same time as North Korea. Come on. You obviously think that you're going to celebrate this no matter what everybody says, or you think that they're going to love it and you're convinced that you don't need to tell them ahead of time. There's just so much hubris there. And for something that has no underlying concept, what are we doing? But it's pros and cons.
Okay, let's as you are sitting there in Taupo, Van, can I draw you out a little bit more? Aside from the sort of brash announcement, how's this being interpreted in New Zealand?
A lot of ambivalence, a lot of wait and see. Part of it is because, like Nick said, you know, this is, we're in the space of press releases, right? Like there hasn't been a lot of action taken. I mean, no action has been taken except for spurning the French. And so at this point, it's too early for anybody to overreact. And I feel like the fact that Jacinda, the prime minister, you know, she got on the phone with Scott Morrison and was like, you know, you do you, man, but just don't bring your subs into our waters. That seems to be, you know, like you don't want to overblow these things, but given that nothing has even happened yet, and that's already the statement, it shows a kind of drift or gap emerging between two countries that used to be thought of as a single strategic entity. You know, like we're going in more and more divergent directions, despite being neighbors. It's just that you haven't seen a lot of formulating of clear New Zealand hard opinions either way about this, because what this is very fuzzy still, but it doesn't look good.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Okay, we have a couple of questions, which I assume are from different perspectives, but they kind of add up to the same thing. It's about the tactics of AUKUS, right? And it's about the tactics of employing nuclear submarines rather than conventional submarines. So Christopher Skinner asks, would the panel agree that the primary motivation for AUKUS was for Australia to acquire nuclear-powered submarines to reflect the inherent limitations of conventional submarines that the French attack class represented? The British nuclear submarine technology could only be supplied with US control. Then, with the lack of need for refueling, their nuclear reactors bypassed the Australian legislative bans. AUKUS was a means for this to be achieved. And from, I think, what is a different perspective, is John Hallam of the People for Nuclear Disarmament Human Survival Project. He asks, it seems to me that absolutely fundamental questions have never been asked. The biggest one is what role, if any, should submarines be playing in Australia's defence? The second tier question only is whether the role is best filled by a relatively noisy nuclear sub or by advanced conventional subs with AIP, I don't know what that is, that has the ability to disappear completely in the depths of the ocean. The answer to the second question may well suggest that nukes may not be the best way to go. Finally, there are questions about what AUKUS does in terms of geopolitics. We've already talked about creating Australia as a nuclear target, I guess. So I think to Van and Ben, you know, those, do you have any insight into those tactical questions? Van, you were just on, so let's go to Ben.
The first question about was AUKUS simply a means of getting these subs? This is a means to an end. From the Australian position, potentially, I don't think necessarily from the US and certainly not the British position. I mean, I think the British win on this is relevance, right? It's being in the room and having something to do post-Brexit and getting to play with high-end technology with, you know, the world superpower is a great way of doing so. From Australia's point of view, yeah, potentially. I mean, it's a very odd way of doing it. You spend years and lots of money trying to figure out how you can get the French to convert their nuclear-powered submarines to conventional ones so we can buy them, to then turn around and decide that actually we do want nuclear-powered ones. We'll just get them from someone else. It's a very odd way of going about it. Although, as Nick has sort of already alluded to, that doesn't mean that's not precisely what's happened, right? We haven't been overwhelmed with, let's put it this way, particularly effective project managers in our federal government in recent years, right? Who are good at delivering deliverables. John's really good question about what role should submarines play in all this. I mean, he's exactly right. I don't think I have an answer for him. I think my answer to the question is just to say that is the right question. The first thing we have to ask is, what do we want our naval forces to do? And this is what Dan's been getting at. What's the strategy that underpins this? What box does this tick? And so far, I've seen no serious discussion from anyone in power, anyone who's actually made this announcement, and very little from those who are proponents of it, that actually tackles this in any serious way. There are some people doing this kind of thinking, You mentioned before, Bryce, Hugh White, his most recent book is about what Australian defence policy should look like. And he goes into all the detail of all of that. And that's just one view, right? But that's what we need a bit more of, asking the what is this for first. That's why I actually don't buy the argument that these are really about tactics and strategy in a military sense. This, I think, is about the politics at the moment that we find ourselves in and hitching ourselves to a particular wagon.
Great.
Yeah, totally. So the operational performance, it's not really a question. You get better performance for missions out of nuclear powered sub versus the French conversion diesel sub. It's just not that that's a statement of fact. That's not necessarily a motivation for doing this whole project, you know? And so the first order question really is essential. And the reason why I'm so like, my eyes are rolling in the back of my head and I'm like pounding the table and screaming into the screen is because the first order questions have not been addressed. And so like, I don't think this turns into World War III or whatever, but it's disconcerting to say the least that you can't ask first order questions before you try and make this kind of decision, you know? So that is definitely what's needed.
I think Maria really like to jump in on this.
Yeah, go Maria.
Look, you know, so, you know, the question about was this a way to just sort of get around the restrictions on Australian nuclear technology so we could still have nuclear subs? Well, then why are we trying to build them in Australia? I mean, if that's the case, then, you know, then let's see if we can just buy some outright. And that's, I mean, one thing that we haven't talked about at all is the role that domestic politics plays in this. And I share, you know, the same sort of concern that the rest of the panelists do, that this is not well thought out. We don't even know what we want to do with these subs. Like I said, ASPE, you know, and their maritime experts have said we need 24 subs for sea denial, let alone sea control. What are we doing with 8? Why are we spending such a big percentage of our defense budget? And that doesn't even count all the stuff we have to do to build up the nuclear industry to support these subs. It just seems, I would love to know, I don't know if we can do this or not, like, is this actually going to happen? And there was another question, you know, what about the role of Australian public opinion? Once people realize what's actually involved, you know, we can't even get approval for a long-term waste facility for low to intermediate nuclear waste from our medical reactor. How are we going to get approval for, you know, anything beyond that? It's just, I look at the media and most of it is just sort of parroting, oh, nuclear subs are great. You know, this is so great for Australia. It's like, have you even thought about these issues? Rant over, sorry.
Okay, very good. Unless anybody wants to add to that, we are over time, but there is a question that's actually kind of similar.
Can I just have just a footnote to Maria's point. I think we're supposed to have, this is a country in which sort of defence acquisition stuff is supposed to go through pretty clear public debate processes, white papers, all that sort of stuff. And you may think it's a bit clunky and cumbersome, but the fact that probably the biggest set of announcements, and they are just announcements, but they're there, about Australian strategic policy and defence for decades occurred without any discussion, any debate, any conversation with close allies, including nuke subs, Tomahawks, cruise missiles, the whole bit, at 7 a.m. on a Thursday. It beggars belief. I mean, it's just staggering that there wasn't at least, you know, if you look at the lead up to 2016, there was significant public debate and discussion around all sorts of things to do with submarines and the defense white paper, and there's that huge consultative exercise. It's just as a process, it's astonishing as an exercise in democracy and civilian control of the military and the Westminster tradition about how you spend money. It's completely, you know, this is a quote unquote conservative government. I mean, por favor, it's, it was really striking. And I think in the context of what we've been doing, it really, left me kind of shaking my head. But as I said before, it's still an announcement and it could all go nowhere, literally. And the fact that the Conservative government hasn't been able to sell Greg Sheridan of all people, who's easily the most easy to convince on these things, is probably telling that I think Maria's question from before is the right one. Is this going to happen?
Okay, I think I might leave it there then. That's actually a great place to leave it. We have gone over time. I'm sorry to those of you who are now watching this on YouTube and had to pull out. But this has been a fantastic discussion, and maybe in 18 months, we should do it all again. Thanks so much to our panelists, Van Jackson, Ben Zala, Maria Ross-Rubley, and Nick Bisley. And thanks so much to all of you. We've had so many questions. Unfortunately, we couldn't get to them all. Come back. As I said, I'm sure this debate is one that will continue throughout our, not only at the National Office of the AIIA, but also at our state and territory branches. And please do remember that we are a membership organization. And if you want to take part in the debate, do join up. Joining the organization gives you free access to all of our webinars, and we have several per week. So again, a very hearty thanks to our speakers and to you as well. And enjoy the rest of your afternoon.